Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Well, I've been so looking forward to this interview. Thanks for tuning in on Thursday afternoon. And this is our latest episode of New Zealand Sporting History. Today's guest on NZ Sporting History not only made an impact on his sport during his time as a competitor, but perhaps even more so after he left it behind. Stephen Swartz was a pro cyclist from 1987 to 1995. He rode in the Tour de France three times and won a total of 9 UCI races. Those are the top ones. But later, Stephen was one of 11 cyclists, who provided testimony to the US Anti-Doping Agency about the culture of performance-enhancing drug use in the sport. This, in combination with his openness with journalists, was a key factor in exposing Lance Armstrong's history of doping and the cover-ups that took place. In 2012, he was named New Zealander of the Year for his courage and bravery in speaking up. And he joins me today from our Christchurch studio. Stephen, hello.
G'day, Jesse. How are you?
Yeah, good. Thanks for your time today.
No problem.
Where did your interest in cycling begin?
Oh, back in the probably mid to late 70s. My older brother Jack, who's probably more well known in New Zealand than I am. We grew up in a little town called Morrinsville in Waikato.
Yeah.
Cycling was back then it was quite a relevant big sport.
Plenty of flats around there.
Oh, you can challenge yourself. You know, flat races can be just as hard as hilly races. But that sort of sparked the interest. You know, following it, and then my sister married one of his mates, and you know, just there was either that or play rugby or soccer. I don't think there was a lot of other choices around at the time.
And you did pretty well looking at your early career. The Junior Worlds in Italy was a highlight, and I think you did pretty well there.
Yeah, I was actually surprised that I did make a. I was working with my brother, and we heard on the radio that I got selected for it. So that was sort of a wow moment. I wasn't expecting anything like that. But I put my head down, and I probably rode above my expectations, and. I saw potential.
Commonwealth Games 86, was that Edinburgh?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, I remember watching that. That was a great Games. And we had a great team as well. So you took home a silver there, which you must have been very pleased with.
Yeah, I thought we could maybe... I mean to say, I think silver was as good as we were going to get. You know, at the time, the Australians were pretty much riding like... our New Zealanders are on the track at the moment. So, you know, very, very, very competitive. Mm. We weren't at that level. But I thought we could give it a bit more of a crack. But, hey, c'est la vie.
Yeah. Has the sport changed much, particularly in terms of training, since those days?
Oh, 1,000%. Everything's changed. I mean, there's no even comparison. You know, I try and follow it now and... you know, from the training aspect to the diets and how it's all worked, and obviously equipment wise, well, that's always evolving anyway. But those two aspects, especially now, you know, with sports science behind it, it's way more advanced than when I left.
What sort of equipment did you have for training?
Oh, just what was available back then. As far as, on a sports science basis, basically a heart rate was about as good as it got.
Okay.
But, there's so many other tools out there that they use now. It's just phenomenal.
In this racing you did in Europe, was there a point at which you moved from amateur to professional, or from track to road? How did that work?
Yeah, well, after the Commonwealth Games in Edinburgh, I was given an opportunity to turn professional. There was another bike rider from Christchurch here, Brian Fowler, who turned down the opportunity. And between Ron Cheatley and a couple of others sort of nominated me as the to progress forward, and I took the opportunity landed in the deep end. But it was either that or, you know, just carry on as you were. There wasn't a lot of opportunities, you know, not like there are now. You know, guys can basically give out their information, you know, off doing off a home trainer, and, you know, like sports directors and their trainers and that can actually have a look at their their power output and all this parameters, but like a racing car, really.
Yeah.
And you know, it doesn't mean that the guy's any good on the bike, but if he's got a big motor, well, you know, we can train him to do everything else, perhaps.
Did you enjoy that life on the tour?
Yeah, I mean, when you're young like that, everything's an adventure, you know, and to be able to ride at that very highest level probably wasn't done in a pragmatic way. It was just an opportunity. When a door opened, you took it. It was hard. there was good times and bad times.
Yeah. And I imagine quite different for you as well, going to a part of the world where cycling is revered, is a national sport rather than a minority sport. It would be, you know, 9th or 10th off the ranks here in New Zealand.
Yeah, yeah. Back, you know, we didn't have the coverage or media exposure from Europe and what we were up to, but, you know, when we were, you know, racing in the smaller Belgium teams, you know, you still had the locals that would come up to you for an autograph, and, you know, a big thing over there is, you know, like a photograph, and they'd all want, you know, like a postcard, and there was collectors of them. They'd always be running around trying to find you to get their autograph.
Yeah.
I've even until as recently as like last year, I think I got one in the post, you know, from someone in, I think it was in Belgium or Holland, asked me if I'd sign it and send it back with in a self-addressed envelope. So he's obviously a collector of,
yeah.
It's weird.
So I imagine a seductive lifestyle too, in many ways, a pretty good life being a star and being treated as a star and doing a sport that you love and getting the occasional win. That all sounds pretty good.
I mean, I was always told, you know, it's a privilege to be at that level. I mean, we were professional, but it wasn't as professional as it is now. And I was always told, you know, it's a privilege to be able to do something that you're good at. And it's probably in business as well, and life in general. So, you know, and if you did well, you know, the other part of it, you know, the rewards come accordingly.
Mm. Can you tell us why the Tour de France has become so famous?
I think because the people that own it, the Society of Tour de France, they basically have bought up quite a big package, and it probably started back in 1986 after Greg LeMond won, first English-speaking rider to win it, and obviously with the US coverage, and then, you know, as it went on, and then there was an American team, 7-Eleven, that started, and obviously the coverage was more than just in Europe then, you know, and as the years have progressed, you know, then we've got a lot of English-speaking riders that have been participating and doing well, not only from the States, but all over the place. So I think it's become a global event, you know, but even though, you know, and it is still, even though it's still, you know, a lap around France, but it's probably something like, you know, Wimbledon, you know, it's the biggest grass court thing. So everyone aims to do that.
Why did you leave the sport?
I was pretty caught in a perfect storm, really. I was probably, you know, looking back at it, I was reaching probably the pinnacle where I could be riding, and I probably had quite a few, maybe 3 or 4 good years in me still. But unfortunately, you know, with what we know now, where it was as far as, you know, the blood boosting and all that, it just didn't sit well, you know. It was getting harder and harder, and, you know, it was just more and more crazy.
When did it first come on your radar?
Oh, I'd known about it for 2 or 3 years. I was riding in the States for about 4 or 5 years, and we'd heard rumours and stuff like that. But, I mean, when I made the transition back to Europe in 94, and I'd been away from there since 88, the difference in the racing was just dramatic. You know, like, back in 88, I could actually climb with some of the best climbers. I wasn't going to be the first over the top, but I wasn't far off it, you know, and that was only sort of in my early stage. So I'm pretty sure if I carried on that trajectory, I might have been, you know, maybe a top 10, top 20 finisher in the Tour de France, because, you know, I think generally I can be a stage race rider. But what I did notice on the return in 94 is it was just a drag race. Every you know, when it really counted, I mean, they say they just went faster. It was just, you know, how else can you explain it? Except, yeah, you know, you just keep getting dropped all the time.
And so you, I guess, have a bit of a quandary. Are you going to do the same thing, or are you going to drop out of the sport? And I think you did. I think you've said that you did try it out.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, 95 was sort of the turning point where, you know, where we were in the team and Motorola, and, you know, the results weren't, 94, they didn't come hardly anything at all, you know, minuscule. So 95 was a bit of a pressure cooker, and, you know, results were really, you know, wanting. You know, they didn't have to speak about it. You can just feel the aura about it all. So, I mean, yeah, between a few of the senior riders, it was, you know, decided that, yes, you know, in order to try and be our best at the Tour de France, then just we were going to have to jump the fence and ride on the other side.
Interesting, because it's tempting to think of people who choose to use performance-enhancing drugs as trying to get an edge so they can win, but it sounds to me like you are just trying to keep up.
Well, we were then, but see, the thing is, there was no controls back then, you know, like, I think it was about 88, 98, I think, the first sort of controls came in where they were testing for or checking your hematocrit, and if you're over 50%, which still theoretically you're taking it, but this is for a health thing, that you had a 2-week stand down period. So, you know, when you got retested, that you would fall below the 50% threshold. Now, that doesn't mean they're not taking it. It was because there was a lot of guys, especially in the early 90s, and that there was a group of riders that sort of died because they thought more was better. But obviously the science all behind it is the coagulation of the blood doesn't seem to flow around the body too good when it's like syrup.
Did you notice a difference when you tried it out?
You don't, like, it's not like taking a, you know, a Panadol and then all of a sudden the headache goes away. This takes time, you know, probably 5 or 6 weeks for it to actually build up in your system. And then once it does take effect, oh, yeah, no, there's no doubt that there's huge benefits. I mean, I can still remember races where, you know, we'd be riding, you know, 5 or 6 hours, you know, and it was full gas, like in the, like before I took it, you know, I'd be absolutely wiped out, but you get off and an hour later you feel as fresh as a daisy.
Why'd you stop?
You mean riding?
Yeah, why'd you stop riding? I guess it's a related question, is why'd you stop doping?
Yeah, well, maybe ethics. Was it a smart thing? Oh, I believe so. I mean, so it didn't sit well with me. But unfortunately, you know, hey, had I carried on for a couple more years before all the testing, oh, you might have seen some great results out of me. I don't know. We'll never know that now.
You don't regret it, though?
No, I don't regret it. I'm a little disappointed that, you know, I was just caught in the crossfire, but hey, that is what it is.
So 1995, I think you left the sport, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and then at what stage did you speak up and why?
Well, I really got approached a few times back in around about 98. There was a Phil Taylor from the New Zealand Herald that, you know, he's a bike rider as well. He sort of made acquaintance with us, and Phil knew where I stood on it all and what had happened. You know, you talk to, you know, outside the media circle, you know, you talk to friends about it and stuff like that. And then he met the David Walsh, who was the gentleman who sort of really didn't believe what was happening at the Tour de France, who followed it for the one of the big English newspapers. And that's where it sort of, you know, when he, after Armstrong, you know, sort of denied everything and, you know, there was enough facts, that's when he sort of approached me and saying, hey, look, we've got this, you know. It didn't happen overnight. It was, you know, probably took over 12 months before, you know, talking between one another before anything sort of evolved.
But, well, yeah, 12 months, just that sort of forming the connection with the journalists. But then I think 7 years between when you first spoke to a journalist and when Lance Armstrong was officially ousted. So that's a long 7 years for you, having done the right thing and presumably getting a fair bit of flack from within the sport.
Yeah, 100%, you know. Yeah, you soon learn who your real friends are and, you know, who's not. So, there was some difficult moments. You know, it was always about the same questions. And I honestly didn't think that the way it turned out, whatever it turned out, but it actually, it's not that I was looking for that, but it's a bit like saying, you know, well, I told you so, you know, no one believing you, you know, it was the power of, you know, the guy in the driver's seat.
You say you definitely found out who your real friends were. Who were they?
Oh, you know, guys that I've, you know, in the cycling world, you know, I grew up with, you know, from day dot sort of thing. And they know, even though they're only based in New Zealand, they know full well what goes on in the big wide scheme of things. So, you know, even though they weren't speaking out proactively, but, you know, they weren't there bagging me for what I did. They, you know, it was it was nice to know that they were there, but there were other, there's other riders in the here that, you know, hey, they only saw one thing really, and you know, whatever Lance said, you know, that was gospel.
Mm.
But obviously, they're reading from the wrong Bible.
Are there two problems here? One, the culture of, well, let's just call it cheating, the culture of cheating, and two, the bullying tactics that they employed to silence people, yourself included.
Well, I don't know if they really actually silenced me. It was all.
Well, they didn't silence you, but they certainly, no. you certainly would have got the message that your contributions weren't welcome.
Oh no, yeah, 100%. I mean, they, obviously, I think, yeah, it's a bit like what we see with Trump these days. You know, they took on that sort of stance. You know, arrogance. But obviously, there was a tipping point where they'd dealt all their cards, and someone else was still holding the joker.
Can you understand having tried it out yourself in '95, and then you walked away from it? But can you understand if you'd progressed, kept doing it, started winning? Can you understand the temptation to try and cover it up and to try and shut down any story that might be coming out about the culture in the sport?
Yeah, well, because basically it's that's what you've signed up to, even though, you know, there's nothing officially on paper, but that's what you've signed up to, isn't it? So that would have been the case, you know. It would have been two-faced if I turned around and started saying, oh, you know, about there's nothing happening when, you know, you're fully engaged in it.
I got a big hello from Dr. Dave Gerard, who is your team doctor at Edinburgh 86. Mm-hmm. Says he really respects your honest account and your integrity still deserves to be celebrated. That must be, just jumping forward, it must have been really special when you were named New Zealander of the Year. That must be vindication.
Yeah, it's nice to be recognised like that, but it wasn't the reason what I was trying to do it for. I mean, it's, you know, the whole point of coming out really was to try and... There's one thing in cycling or all sports, I guess, we've all got access to the training, the diets, the equipment, but there's one unwritten area don't bag me, but I'm pretty sure it still exists now, is the medical side, and you know, that's the difference between winning and losing.
What do you make of Lance Armstrong? What should we think of him? What's your view of him, having watched it from, I guess, behind the scenes and watched it all unfold?
Yeah, it's a hard one. I mean, maybe over time I've sort of softened, but I feel sorry for him that it sort of led that way. I think he thought he was never... You know, it was never going to get exposed, and if he said, "I've never," you know, if he said no enough times, then eventually people will get it. But you know, it didn't work out that way.
Must have been a wild ride for you once it started getting printed and the story came out.
Yeah, no, there was a lot of bad times, but more than good times.
Tell me about that.
Just, you know, the always having the finger pointed at you, you know, and then obviously, you know, the family at home, maybe the kids didn't really get too much because they were still relatively young, but, you know, the wife felt it and things like that, you know, so it just made things really uncomfortable sometimes, you know. But hey, you know, you've put your... you put made your line in the sand, you know, that's it. You can't go back on it.
I read somewhere that you decided to speak up in part because of your son.
Well, that's reasons why I did speak up. It was because, like I said, that's, you know, if you're, my son was interested in riding and, you know, I mean, how could you go, you know, get him to, say, if he went to the highest level and say, oh, you know, hey, this is all there is to it, and leave the, I don't know, what would you call it, the piece of gold, telling him that, you know, it's, or the, there's nothing else to tell you, yeah. You know.
You would have been forced to look your son in the eye and say, hey, if you work hard enough, you'll get there.
Yes, you know, that's probably 99% of it, but the missing link, you know, if he, all you could do is try and help him and not make the same mistakes you did.
Yeah. From what you've observed, do you feel the culture in the sport has changed dramatically since those days?
When that all came down, I think, yes, it did. That whole, with all the protocols they put in place and stuff like that. But as far as, you know, guys looking for an advantage, that hasn't changed. And if it's in the medical field that they're trying to get an advantage, that hasn't changed. We've heard stories of, you know, electric motors and bikes now, you know, so, you know, the UCI checks the bikes for that. So I think that's just part of sport, any business, anything really, you know, people are looking for an edge. You know, because that's the difference between making it and not making it.
Is it a money thing?
Well, that's part of it. Yeah, it's probably a big driver, but also, you know, recognition, success. You know, no one wants to just ride around, you know, for, you know, just for the sake of it. You know. That's their job, you know. There's a time limit on it. So if they want to have a successful career, then perhaps that's what, you know, some of them will look at it that way.
Are you proud of the stand you took?
Yeah, I am. I'm proud of it, I guess. Well, I've never really looked at it that way, but I've only just sort of tried to explain what happened, what I was in, what happened. And, you know, so it's on record, and maybe people can learn from that, learn something from it, and it won't happen, but I don't know. I think we're sort of maybe heading down the same road again.
But do you feel like you made a positive difference? Do you feel like the sport changed for the better because of what you did?
Not only just myself, but, you know, the people that spoke out, because obviously if Armstrong did get away with it and nothing was done, where would the sport be now? Where would sports be now?
You still enjoy watching?
Yeah, I still enjoy the watching of it. Yeah, sometimes it's gets a little bit boring, I guess, because of the technology that's involved. You know, especially with race radios. You know, everything's very more clinical.
Stephen Swart, really appreciate your time today. Thanks so much.
No worries.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.